This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Wednesday, the Federal Energy Minister defends the government's focus on coal-fired power. And could a discovery by Australian scientists deliver a global breakthrough on treating cervical cancer?
They have made incredible discovery and hopefully on the way to curing the big C. Cancer is a terrible disease, and you know, if you haven't had it yourself, you know someone who has, and that's the terrible part about it.
But we begin this lunchtime in northern New South Wales, where two huge bushfires, which have already destroyed scores of homes, have now merged, creating a fire ground almost 100 kilometres long. The dangerous combination of westerly winds and intense heat yesterday saw the flames destroy or damage 30 homes, mostly around the town of Rapville. Our reporter Bronwyn Herbert has the latest.
Soot-covered residents from the village of Rapville arrived at the evacuation centre, many still grappling with the fact they had lost their home and all their possessions.
We lost everything, mate. What I've got on, that's what I've got. You know, I'm not just the only one. There's other people around has too, so we just got to stick together and still alive and still got a good community, and we'll see what happens.
The fires in the far north of New South Wales picked up yesterday with winds of up to 80 kilometres an hour and a record high October temperature in Casino of 41 degrees. The Busby's Flat Fire, just to the south of Casino, sent an inferno of flames towards the villages of Rapville and Ewingar.
Everything's gone. Fencing, cattle. My house is gone, the brick home's gone.
Janelle McLennan lives at Mongogery, about 20 kilometres from Rapville. She says it's been harrowing.
We're at the edge of the fire, so we've been monitoring it overnight, so we sort of got very little sleep, just keeping an eye on it. So it's probably about three or five kilometres from us. You can see the glow, and it's just up the road. And it is very scary. I can't imagine how everybody felt who was in the midst of it yesterday. And I said to other people, look, the wind was blowing so fiercely yesterday that you could have had every firefighter in New South Wales fighting the blaze and they wouldn't have been able to stop it. It was just unstoppable, really scary.
Early this morning, the Busby's Flat Fire joined with the Long Gully Fire, which had been burning for a month, creating a mammoth fire scar. The fire now stretches almost 100 kilometres from Drake and the Clarence River in the west all the way to Bungawalban Creek near the town of Woodburn on the Pacific Highway. The mayor of the Richmond Valley Shire says locals are still trying to work out how many homes have been lost to the bushfire. Robert Musto says the timber mill was also lost, but locals twice saved the Rapville pub when it caught on fire. He says it's a tough time for everyone.
I'm broken. I really am. As I said, we're a resilient lot. My heartfelt feelings go out for our community.
The Rural Fire Service has had 1,000 firefighters on the ground across the several blazes burning in the north. RFS Deputy Commissioner Rob Rogers says the gusty winds and yesterday's ferocious heat challenged their efforts.
We're just making sure we know what properties were lost and damaged, making sure people are accounted for, and just making sure we understand and try and get those areas as safe as we can so people that haven't lost their homes can return. There's power lines still down, there's a lot of trees falling down, so there's a lot of work to do, which is what our focus will be on those communities today.
He says fire investigators are looking at how the fire started and whether it was embers blowing ahead to the east from the massive fire at Long Gully that created the new blaze.
It is possible that fire was burning for a few hours, but look, it is possible. We have fire investigators allocated to that fire to try and get to the bottom of that, because obviously it's pretty important for us to work out, was that embers, was it caused by humans, deliberate or accidental, so that we can work very well closely with police to ensure if there was people involved in that fire that obviously they're brought to the attention of police. So
there are also heartwarming stories emerging, including how a tweet to the Rural Fire Service managed to save a couple who were hiding in a shed at Rapville. Carol Duncan says her father, John, and his partner, Cass, were in trouble, but firefighters managed to help them escape just in time.
I replied to the RFS saying my father and his partner are in their shed. And they then messaged me privately asking where he was and the address, and they sent some volunteers with a truck to get them out of the shed. About an hour after that, we found out that, in fact, the shed had gone.
Conditions have eased on the ground for now, providing a respite for firefighters to continue to try and build containment lines.
Bronwyn Herbert reporting in northern New South Wales. Well, let's go now across the border to Queensland, where emergency authorities are also monitoring several fires this lunchtime. Firefighting conditions there have also improved, but the Queensland Fire and Emergency Service has confirmed that the intense fire in the Lockyer Valley has destroyed at least one home in the community of Laidley. Our reporter George Roberts was in Laidley this morning. George, give us a sense of how quickly this fire took hold.
Well, Eleanor, it really took authorities by surprise. They had most of their fire crews off fighting other fires, like the fire at Thornton. When this started as a grass fire, it tore across a paddock and very quickly engulfed the one house that it's completely destroyed. And to give you an example of the intensity and the heat involved in that fire, there's a mangled metal dinghy out the front, which is almost completely melted, as well as a ute that's buckled and melted. The metal has twisted from the heat, and of course, you know, the house is pretty much mostly destroyed. There's certainly nothing worth living in there now. Incredibly, it's gone around the other houses, and the authorities managed, once they started getting multiple helicopters in, they were just firebombing one after another. At one point, they were sort of queuing up, hovering over a small reservoir to fill up and then go and water bomb the fire. They did manage to get it under control and contained and then extinguished overnight. But it was how quickly this fire whipped up and the very dry conditions that are here that shows the ever-present danger through this fire season that this region is facing.
And you were saying that the authorities were actually focusing on other fires. How many fires are still burning in the state?
Well, at last count, authorities said that there were about 25 fires that authorities are monitoring across the state. To give you an example, here in the Lockyer Valley, last night, they had 100 fire trucks. So that's 100 fire crews on the ground fighting fires. Here alone at Laidley in the sky, there were three or four helicopters, some with snorkels, some with buckets. And then there were also light planes like crop dusters and things picking up water and trying to dump that on the fire. So their strategy is when a fire whips up, they try to jump on it straight away. Here at Laidley, they couldn't get onto it quick enough, and that's why one home was lost, but incredibly so many more were saved.
And there are cooler conditions today. What are the firefighters saying about the sort of progress that they're hoping to make with these fires?
Well, look, they are grateful that those conditions are better. It certainly is a lot cooler today. We don't have those gusting winds that we had yesterday. There's barely a breeze, which is really good news, because that is one of the things that makes it so hard to fight the fires, even in cooler conditions. So while there's a bit of reprieve now, they're hoping they can get on top of all the fires that are causing the biggest problems. But, of course, they're saying they're in it for the long haul. They expect this fire season to be long, to be grueling, and they don't say that they can breathe easy yet.
That's George Roberts in Queensland's Lockyer Valley. Well, with Australia facing extreme temperatures even before summer has started, the political debate over power prices and climate change is also heating up. The head of Australia's Energy Security Board says the federal government's focus on ageing coal-fired power plants is, quote, ill-advised. But the Federal Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, has defended the government's policy. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
The impending closure of the ageing Liddell coal-fired power plant in New South Wales is, once again, the battleground for the energy debate.
We believe we need to focus on making the most of what we have.
That's Energy Minister Angus Taylor, who recently has been redoubling the government's efforts to keep Liddell open, with a task force and legislation set to come before Parliament that would give it the power to force the sale of Liddell to anyone who'd keep it going past its planned closure date.
For too long, this industry has suffered from the triumph of hope over reality. Not this time. The goal must be to create a sensible precedent for how we deal with planned closures in the future.
But writing in the Australian Financial Review today, the head of the Energy Security Board, Kerry Schott, takes issue with the government's heavy-handed approach.
Government interventions to both cap prices and effectively subsidise certain generation projects will not encourage the considerable new investment and innovation that is needed.
And she's particularly critical of the government's efforts to keep Liddell open past its 2022 closing date.
The ongoing and costly efforts to keep aged coal plants running for extended periods is also ill-advised. It discourages firms from giving adequate notice of closure, and it discourages new investment in firm and flexible plants.
Angus Taylor was today speaking at a conference organised by the Financial Review. Journalist Mark Ludlow put Ms Schott's comments to the minister.
Questioning some of the interventions is ill-advised. Obviously, you've got a response to that?
There has to be a very strong focus on balancing the system between the intermittency that is happening at an unprecedented rate, at a record rate, and dispatchability.
What do you say to the claim, though, that intervention, even if it is, albeit meant to be short-term, whether price capped or underwriting new generation, does distort the market and deter private sector investment? It's not sending the right signal to investors.
Well, I mean, you know, these reforms have all come on the back of the ACCC's report of July last year.
But if the government's own bureaucrats are asking the tough questions at the moment, it's having an easier time with the opposition. Labor's energy policy is, like everything else, under review at the moment. Shadow Resources Minister Joel Fitzgibbon will use a speech tonight to argue Labor should adopt the same carbon emissions targets as the government after aggressive renewables targets cost it votes at the last election. But the debate is still a difficult one for Labor, which wants to be seen as providing a credible alternative to the government on the issue of dealing with climate change. Labor MP Peter Khalil, speaking on Sky News this morning, pointedly refused to back Joel Fitzgibbon's call.
We have to look at the evidence base. We have to make some calculations about where we might be at, given this government's dragging its heels. Emissions are actually rising under this government.
That's Labor MP Peter Khalil ending Tom Eagledon's report. Heading overseas, and the Turkish military has now fired the first shots on the border with Syria since the US president's surprise announcement on the withdrawal of US troops. The Turkish government is vowing to push ahead with its invasion of the Kurdish-held northeast, despite the warning from the United States to limit its attack. And there have been impassioned calls from Kurds, both in the border region and around the world, including on the steps of the White House, for the international community to protect them. Gavin Coote has the latest.
Syrians gather at the border, chanting no for the Turkish occupation. They're angrily denouncing Turkey's plans to advance into the Kurdish-controlled territory. And this protester says Syrians are standing united as they call for peace.
The Turkish plan is an occupation of the land, and they are coming to occupy our land.
But Turkey remains ready to invade northeast Syria. Now the United States has begun withdrawing troops from the border. It's launched the first strike on the Syria-Iraq border, aimed at cutting off a transport route used by Kurdish forces. As Turkey bolsters its position, US President Donald Trump has warned the country against overstepping the mark. President Trump had earlier praised Turkey as a trade partner, but threatened to totally destroy its economy if it acted off-limits in Syria. And while he's batted off suggestions he's abandoned the Kurdish forces in their fight against Islamic State, the decision to remove US troops from the region is continuing to cause anger both in Syria and back in Washington.
Turkey out of Syria!
Demonstrators outside the White House have urged Donald Trump to immediately reverse his decision. Rohat Artes, who's Kurdish and was born in Turkey, says he believes a looming conflict won't be limited to Syria.
The Kurds in Turkey, the Kurds in everywhere, like in the world, they're not going to just like watch everything silently. It's just the war is going to spread out like in the Turkish part of Kurdistan, in Iraqi part of Kurdistan.
There's been a rare show of bipartisanship, with both Republicans and Democrats lashing the president's decision. And the united criticism has spread across religious lines too.
Welcome to this edition of the 700 Club.
On his show on the Christian Broadcasting Network, US televangelist Pat Robertson has warned the Kurds are now in grave danger of being massacred.
The president of the United States is in danger of losing the mandate of heaven if he permits this to happen.
Australia's government has expressed concern about the rising conflict, saying Kurdish forces will be in a very difficult situation if Turkey advances into Kurdish-held areas.
Gavin Coote reporting. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Queensland cancer researchers say they've made a world-first breakthrough in the fight against cervical cancer. The scientists at Griffith University have used gene editing technology to destroy tumours in mice, and they're planning to conduct human trials in the next 5 years. In Brisbane, Rachel Mealy reports.
Like many moments in science, this breakthrough wasn't part of the original plan. Nigel McMillan is the Director of Infectious Disease and Immunology at the Menzies Health Institute in Queensland. He says the light bulb moment came when a researcher on the team broke ranks.
The student who actually did the experiments, Lookman, he went away and did something I didn't really ask him to do, and he added extra treatments into the regime. And it turned out to be the light bulb moment because our normal series of three treatments, you know, slowed cancer down. But when he added the extra three or four treatments after that, it completely disappeared. And that was just one of those serendipitous things that happens.
The researchers used a gene editing tool known as CRISPR to target a gene found in cancers caused by the human papillomavirus. The CRISPR method was developed overseas a few years ago, but the scientists here adapted it for attacking cancer cells in mice.
What we've done is we've taken some little nanoparticles and injected them into the bloodstream of our models, our animal models, and this CRISPR technology finds its way into the cell, and it has a little address mark on it that allows it to find a particular gene, and it disables it. It cuts it in half. This is our missing toolkit we have in our gene therapy toolbox. It's like fixing your car while you're running along the M1 doing 100 Ks. It's working while the cell's working. What it effectively does is it adds a couple of letters into the gene we're looking at, and it no longer is recognized, and so we completely disable that gene. It's like a spell checker where you add in a couple of extra letters and it no longer recognizes the word.
Professor McMillan says there's a lot of work to do. The research team plans to conduct human trials in the next 5 years, but he's already excited about the potential implications of the discovery.
We actually know that a third of all cancers in the world are caused by infectious organisms. So this particular treatment would be fantastic because we're targeting foreign genes, genes that aren't normally in our genome. About 5% of all world cancers are caused by HPV, and this includes cervical cancer, vaginal cancer, but also head and neck cancer. And there is just a tsunami of head and neck cancers coming along in Australia and around the world caused by HPV. And really, this is probably the cancer that it will be most useful for.
Janine McLean was diagnosed with cervical cancer 15 years ago. She chose to undergo a hysterectomy to treat her cancer and says this breakthrough could change lives.
Thank you to that student who didn't follow the direction, because they have made incredible discovery and hopefully on the way to curing the big C. Cancer is a terrible disease, and you know, if you haven't had it yourself, you know someone who has, and that's the terrible part about it.
That's cancer survivor Janine McLean, and that report from Rachel Mealy and Lexi Hamilton-Smith in Brisbane. Environmental groups and scientists are calling on the New South Wales and Victorian governments to improve their policies on plastic pollution ahead of a meeting of the country's environment ministers next month. A scorecard by environment lobby group WWF has ranked Australia's two most populous states last and second last in dealing with plastic waste, as Stephanie Smale reports.
For the past 6 years, University of Tasmania and CSIRO plastics researcher Kathy Willis has been monitoring plastic pollution on beaches right around the Australian coastline.
Plastic is still by far the number one litter item that we find on our coast, and it's still, you know, fragmented bits of plastic. We still find, you know, plastics like candy wrappers and film plastics all the way up to bottles or broken containers.
As the debate swirls around government action on plastic pollution, Kathy Willis has been looking at the ways local councils tackle litter, cross-checking their progress by looking at how much waste ends up on the coastline. And she says in the absence of action on a state and federal level in some parts of the country, councils are trying to lead the way.
Where I'm living in Hobart, the council is just passed a single-use plastic bylaw, even though the Tasmanian state government hasn't necessarily put in a single-use plastic ban. New South Wales, they might not have a plastic bag ban, but there's many local councils that encourage their residents to take reusable shopping bags to their supermarkets and things.
But major change will require policy shifts and funding. And when state and territory environment ministers meet their federal counterparts next month, they're expected to lock in policies such as more spending on recycled items like office supplies for the day-to-day running of government departments in a bid to boost the recycling industry. Katinka Day from WWF Australia says a scorecard from the lobby group suggests Victoria and New South Wales should move on plastic bags and container deposit schemes too.
New South Wales and Victoria came towards the bottom of the pile, and that's because New South Wales doesn't have a plastic bag ban and Victoria doesn't have a container deposit scheme. So the scorecard really highlights that there is room for these states and territories to move on plastics.
Trevor Thornton is a lecturer in hazardous materials management at Deakin University. He says Victoria's lack of action doesn't reflect community expectations.
We've got to come up with, in Victoria, a container deposit scheme. Every other state has either got it or planning to put it in place.
He says there are high expectations of next month's ministers' meeting, but there are no guarantees of any major policy changes.
What comes out of that meeting will tell us where the state governments are wanting to go and what they're likely to do. The problem is you can have a federal government saying a lot of things, but it's up to the state governments to actually implement it and put the incentives or the levies or the whatever strategies in place to make sure things happen.
That's Trevor Thornton from Deakin University, Stephanie Smale with that report. Well, now to our story about a charity operating in parks across the country offering free health care to the pets of people who are homeless. While the charity is national, the volunteer vets are particularly busy in Hobart, where rental prices are rising rapidly and pet-friendly properties can be hard to find. Felicity Ogilvie has been finding out how the service works.
Good boy, Dex. Can you sit?
Oh, good boy.
You do paw?
In a Hobart park, Dexter, the Kelpie Cross Labrador, is having a free checkup.
Oh, thank you. Good boy.
Vet Gabby Lawson examines Dexter's heart and lungs before giving him a clean bill of health.
He was wormed last month, and I think we said he's due for his vaccination next month.
For owner Beck Earth, Dexter is more than just a dog.
Oh, he's like my son. I can't have children of my own, so just having Dexter is just so beautiful. Like, we've got such a beautiful bond.
The dog means so much to Beck Earth that she refused to give him up when faced with eviction from her rental for having a pet.
I was going through such a hard time in my life where people just weren't being friendly to me, and I just thought, you know, having this little man by my side meant more than having a home, because eventually I would get a home.
Almost an hour's drive south of Hobart in the Huon Valley, an animal sanctuary is being overwhelmed with a number of people wanting to surrender their pets because of rental restrictions. The founder and manager of the Brightside Sanctuary, Emma Haswell, is getting calls every week from people who can't find pet-friendly houses.
It's really horrendous. You never forget having people here. I've had a few women recently, and they just... It's really awful to see people go through so much distress and sadness as they surrender their best friend.
Back in Hobart, those who choose their pets over a home are attending the free mobile vet service. The Pets in the Park charity started in Sydney a decade ago and now provides free monthly clinics in most states across the country. Volunteers such as vet Gabby Lawson run the Hobart Clinic, which has now seen more than 180 cats and dogs since it opened last year.
We can really see that we are actually making a difference, and without us, the animals just wouldn't get the care that they needed.
Beck Earth says the mobile vet clinic has given her much more than free healthcare for her dog.
Pets in the Park helped me, just making me learn to lose my anxiety, to be able to deal with Dexter. And then Dexter brought me out of my shell to be able to get a job.
Beck Earth is now living in social housing where her dog is welcome.
It's just really beautiful to see how far he's come and how far we've actually both come as a team. Hey, baby.
Beck Earth and her dog Dexter. That report from Felicity Ogilvie. And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Angela Wypierre, and we're from the ABC's Daily News and Current Affairs podcast, The Signal.
Donald Trump has been itching to get US troops out of Syria for a very long time, and now he is getting his way. That means the US is walking away from the Kurds, a group that was right on the front lines defeating ISIS.
The Kurds are often talked about as the good guys in this region, and without US support, they're staring down a Turkish invasion. But is it really that simple? And could the US be about to score a massive own goal here?
That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.